My name is Lawrence Allen.
I'm Ronald Shaw.
I'm Rahul Vora.
And this is Bad Time Radio.
Welcome to another episode of Bad Time Radio. This time, we're doing an old-time radio episode, and as is tradition, we're joined by Dan from the Thronderdome and Cannonball podcast. Dan, thank you so much for spending time with us on dumb shit yet again.
There's nothing more I like to do. I love dumb shit. I love yakking with cool guys, so this is really right up my alley.
Yeah. I love that Thronderdome is like your lead podcast now.
Well, it's kind of
Cannonball is great, but it's been on hold for so long, I feel like.
Yeah, it's been kind of back burner for me and Claude. I actually need to figure out our plan to get that back up and running, because our next one is actually one I really like, Persuasion by Jane Austen. Which I'll be rereading, and which is a hilarious book, and I would love to talk about how funny Jane Austen is. But yeah, as for right now, I guess most of my energy is on the 90s Star Wars novels podcast. So I'm doing really important work. Yeah,
such a an historic author, really worth truly deep diving. Yeah,
I mean, one of the real titans of American letters. So really, really worth digging into, honestly.
Oh yeah, no, I was just gonna say, I'd assume the Western canon would include Timothy Zahn if it had been created a little bit later.
Yeah, that's right. We're gonna have to double dip in the Cannonball.
You build a time machine and just start hucking copies of Heir to the Empire at Harold Bloom. Be like, read this, you fucking nerd. Where's your canon now, you bastard?
Yeah.
Anyways, and we're talking about an episode of maybe our favorite series, actually, Dark Fantasy. We're talking about Men Call Me Mad, which aired in 1941. I forget the exact date. So kind of keep that in mind when we're talking about this.
Keep in mind, it was actually, I look on the file that you sent me. It was a couple weeks after Pearl Harbor.
Jesus fucking Christ. Whoa. Perhaps that explains the writing. The writer was very distracted by other things.
So yeah, there's heavy stuff going down.
Yeah.
The weird part is... Yeah, no, never mind. Go ahead.
I just want to say that this is a sort of a work of science fiction / fantasy, which, based on my reading at least, was in a very weird spot in the early 40s. It was sort of trying to crawl out a little bit of like the Edgar Rice Burroughs / like just westerns but in space that had dominated in like the 20s through the 30s, but it still wasn't like hitting the like actual psychological realism. We're trying to have worlds that kind of make sense that would start happening in the 50s, and instead you end up with all this like sort of weird like semi-gothic shit, and also not much delineation between science fiction, fantasy, and horror. In fact, fantasy in particular, aside from the very specific sword and sorcery genre, had not been codified at all, because like Lord of the Rings or that one like Three Lions and the Chevalier or whatever that one's called hadn't come out. So like no one really knew what the fuck fantasy was particularly. It's just, if it wasn't science fiction or horror and it took place maybe in kind of the past, you'd call it fantasy. So yeah.
Yeah, I think this was very much in a mode of, do you guys know the author Abraham Merritt?
Okay.
Or credited as A. Merritt. So he's a guy who was writing in the, mostly in the 20s was kind of his big sort of period of flourishing. But he was very much, his most famous one was one called The Moon Pool. And he had a few other ones, but he was definitely in that mode of like kind of weird fiction adjacent, but very much in that mode of like the transition between, like a King Solomon's Mines style adventure story shading into what we would know as like fantasy proper. So it's like stories about a contemporary person finding the mystery world or the fantastical world. Whereas I think one of the hallmarks of like fantasy as we know it is, well, I guess that gets kind of squishy too, but like Lord of the Rings exists on its own, right?
Yeah.
Like it's a story that's told. It's not like J.R.R. Tolkien finds a magic book in the Bodleian and gets transported to Middle Earth. No, it's like we're just dropped in and it just is on its own. But I in listening to this one, I thought it felt very, it fit very much in the A. Merritt style of like, there is a lot of fantastical and quasi science fictional elements at work. But it's still pretty grounded, in the sense that your point of view characters are always contemporary to who the reader.
Yeah. You know, I'm going to clarify. I actually have read an A. Merritt story. I read The Challenge from Beyond, that absolutely insane one that he wrote with like H.P. Lovecraft, Robert E. Howard, C.L. Moore, yeah, and Frank Belknap Long, where it's like just this guy goes to the moon or something, and like there's these weird centipedes, and then Robert E. Howard took over, so he had the guy just beat all the centipedes to death.
Yes, exactly.
Oh, I do love Robert E. Howard, man.
Love that guy.
he knows how to write a story.
Yeah. Anyways, so I guess let's go around and would you recommend this episode? I'll go first. If this were any, it's weird because this should probably be longer because it doesn't really do anything with any of its ideas. But on the other hand, I think if it was longer, it would bore me. And as it is, it's pretty funny and fun. So I say check it out. 1.2 speed, maybe, even though it is only 22 minutes. But you could do worse. This is an agreeable enough way of just killing some fucking time. Dan, what do you think?
I would concur. This is not one that I... If I were crafting an anthology of 1940s fantastical fiction, I would probably pass over it. But it's, you know, and it may just be, I don't know, it may just be like because it had enough sort of historical curiosity as like the kind of story that would come around at that time, that I did get a lot out of it. I thought it was pretty enjoyable. And even the places where it was clunky, it was like clunky in a charming way almost.
And Ronald, what did you think?
I liked this one well enough, but I'd still probably not. I'd probably give it a caution. It's just, it is a fun way to spend your time. And maybe there's some historical merit here that you can kind of observe in person. But it's the writing is just all over the place. It's literally like a daydream I would have had in middle school while I wasn't paying attention to the teacher. Like this, it feels that level of like incoherent and like self-aggrandizing kind of of a story. So I had a good time with it. I agree with Lawrence. It's like there's a lot worse ways of spending 25 minutes, and the fact that it's only 25 minutes long really almost pushes it to a recommend. But this is kind of a kind of story for me, so I'd give it a caution, light thumbs down.
And Rahul, what do you think?
No, I don't recommend it because I feel like it didn't end right.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like it ended like halfway through a story, and that's just like it just pisses me off when that happens. I don't know why.
I actually heard that they were going to make a second one, but Netflix canceled it.
Yeah.
Oh no.
They decided to only adapt the first half of the book to try to ensure that they got picked up for a second season, but you know.
Yeah, it didn't work.
I don't know. I felt like it ended really abruptly. Like I was literally questioning if I accidentally fast forwarded through half of it. I was like, wait, listen to it all, or
you have to end the story on a sense of unknown. You can't end it with just like everything resolving. That's like a fairy tale, bro. Come on.
And as opposed to this thing about a guy going to a magic land in a moonbeam. Not fairy tale.
This is very serious.
Joining the princess to save the kingdom from, that's really, come on. We got
typhus.
So. That's real. That's the real thing. Yeah. Anyways, you guys want to go ahead and roll for the summary?
Sure.
It's me. Okay. Ronald, can I get a timer?
60 seconds on the clock.
Okay, here we go. So we open on a guy and he's talking to his two friends and he's like, hey guys, I want to show you a movie or some pictures. And he shows them some pictures and it's of a moonbeam. But when he like flips over to it, changes color and there's like a guy in the moonbeam, like really small, riding a weird animal. And then he's like, hey, watch this. And he drinks something that like shrinks him down and then somehow puts himself in the moonbeam. And then he meets a pretty princess and a king in the moonbeam. But everyone in the moonbeam is dying of the plague, but it turns out that the plague is just typhus, and he happens to know the cure for typhoid fever, so he just cures it. But then he has to leave the moonbeam, and then he's like, hey guys, I need you to come to a hearing because I'm being assessed for competency because my sister wants to steal my oil wells by having me committed. And so he goes to the competency hearing and for some reason makes the insane decision to tell them about the moonbeam planet. But And his friends are going to come and say there's a moonbeam planet, but it's, they both die in a car crash. So he gets committed. But then the very last image is he sees a moonbeam and hears the lady's voice who he had fallen in love with. And she loved him. And I guess maybe he goes into the moonbeam, except he doesn't have any of the equipment that lets him go into the moonbeam. Oh, and I know that it sounds like I just made that shit up, but that is, that's what happened.
And the transitions were just, were you said them all. Like, they didn't really have that much lead-in from one plot point to the next.
I think the only thing I left out was this extremely boring scene where he and the princess confess their love for one another, which sucked.
Come on now, that's just Lawrence. That's just juvenile icky girls stuff. That scene was pivotal.
Why do you hate girls so much, Lawrence? I loved that scene. I love you.
Yeah. I love you too. Yeah. Are you going to say what I think you're going
to
say?
Do you have
wrong
to go?
I love you?
I have
is
to
it
go,
wrong
but for... I'll be back.
It is pretty amazing that they managed to cram, like, so you have crooked oil well dealings, a psychiatric evaluation, a John Marsha love scene, and super science with a shrink pill, and fantasy what the fuck ever with that. And can you guys help me out with this? Like, they were talking about, like, you know, oh, there are worlds, you know, contained within atoms, and maybe we're an atom of a bigger world, you know, dorm room gravity bomb kind of shit.
Yeah.
But
the end of, like, in black.
Right. So when they say it's a world in the moonbeam, do they mean that you're able to travel along the moonbeam to where on the moon this atom is, or is it on the very photons that are comprise the moonbeam?
I mean, I'm thinking that they didn't have an understanding, or the writers have an understanding of the individual elements of a ray of light.
Yeah, because if they did, right. I mean, you get a picture of that, the thing on the photon once, and then you will never see it again.
Right, yeah.
It's like, going to just that, bounce, like, off into fucking space.
Maybe it was more like a prism, the moonbeam.
Guys, it, I'm going to level with you.
It revealed it.
It's very possible we have now thought about this longer than the writer did. And we haven't thought about it very long.
I am certain that, like, is the thing, what's so funny is, like, with the crooked oil well shit, is just, like, it feels like somebody had, like, notes for three or four different story ideas they were kicking around, and, like, I don't know, then Pearl Harbor happened, and they had to, like, for whatever reason, they had to, like, really pull something together really fast. I don't know. And so, look, they just kind of, like,
the show must go on. He just, like, takes, like, three piles on his desk and just puts them together.
He cut up all of his story ideas into little split things of paper, threw them in the air, and then picked them up at random. And that was
yeah, it. And it's like okay, that, okay. That works for, like, William S. Burroughs writing, you know, drug-addled experimental prose. But, like, come on, buddy, you're a hack churning out the, you know, dark fantasy. Like, that's not the way to do it.
Oh yeah, go ahead.
No, please.
Well, that's why I said this is kind of like a middle school daydream for me, because it's both self-aggrandizing, where there's scientist genius figured out both a shrinking potion and that other worlds exist, and he also cured typhus, like, all in the span of like 5 minutes. But he's also persecuted by people who should love him, and looks crazy, even though he's a genius and he's maybe the smartest man on the planet. And his friends died in a car accident. Like, all this crazy shit happened, like, all at once. And he never does anything really wrong. And yet, he's still, like, so persecuted. That's, like, the exact feelings I got when, you know, I was, like, in middle school and, like, thinking about, like, random scenarios where it's like, wow, I bet everyone would feel really bad for me if, you know, like, someone randomly, you know, did something wrong to me and it wasn't even my fault.
Yeah, I wish Rahul would stop bullying me.
Probably.
No, that's an interesting point. I didn't really think about it, but you're right.
Yeah.
He is, like, the great man, and and he gets owned by his sister.
Yeah, for, like, no reason, too. I mean,
all the money.
I mean, he gets owned because he was stupid enough to, when he had a competency here, like, be like, hey, let me tell you about this moonbeam planet.
He was like, I have to do this prior to my...
What? Yeah. What are you talking about?
Tell them about the moonbeam.
Are you really the smartest man?
I'm doing experiments in my lab. That's all you have to say.
Yeah.
I'm not hurting anyone.
And on the off chance that he told his sister about it a little bit, you just go, listen, it's the 1940s. She's a woman. I'm a man. I'm saying she's lying. Who do you believe?
And not just a man in a white lab coat. I mean, come on.
And I can bring in some other men to also say she's lying. Oh, no, they died in a car crash.
I thought it was also funny how they were like being a doctor meant that you could like make a shrinking potion and find parallel planets in a moonbeam
and whip out a cure for typhoid, which it's actually ambiguous to me whether that exists or not. There would have been a vaccine at this point, but they're talking about it like it's a cure. And I believe that the only cure for typhoid fever is actually antibiotics, which existed at this time, but were not common.
Yeah. It would have been antibiotic treatment, which does lead me to think like, well, now where did he get a hold of some penicillin in the moonbeam land? I mean, I guess, you know, since everything else is the same, except that was fun about like the way that the moonbeam world was described is it was like everything had like a different color. Like it was all the same. There were trees, water, a sun, all that stuff that we know and love here. But it was their color was on the opposite side of the color wheel.
Yeah.
And yeah, also their horses are weird. But
right. Green stuff
their
was red. Yeah.
Features were subtly different.
Yeah. It was really funny. Like I realized like the second time he was describing like what he was seeing is like, oh, and the water is orange and the sun is a bright blue. And I was like, hey, wait a minute. You just whipped out your you know, middle school art school color wheel and did the complimentary colors.
It's antimatter or something.
That's yeah.
Are there antimatter photons?
Yeah, they're called wait a minute. Oh, I used to know this. No, so photons, I want to say, are the same for matter and antimatter. I'm not sure now. Fuck.
I'm not sure either.
All right. Yeah.
Well, I mean, I guess you couldn't. Yeah. I guess they wouldn't just look reverse. They would probably explode your eye. But
well, exactly. But he took the pill. he took his little potion. I do like the fact that this guy had like his little film reel of this amazing world he discovered, and then he just fucking big dicks on his on his laboratory friends by saying like, yeah, and I also invented a shrinking pill potion thingy. Yeah, right. So like this is like no problem for me.
And then they're like, my cat or something.
Yeah, he apparently made them hang out in his room for 4 days, and they're just like, okay, sure,
right.
Yeah, I mean, they're doctors in the 40s. They have nothing better to do.
Yeah, they definitely don't have to grapple with the fact that they're now at war with Nazi Germany.
That's for sure.
And one thing, I went to the tape to check on this, and are any of y'all familiar with the Theodore Sturgeon story, The Microcosmic God?
No.
Okay, so you might be familiar with, do you remember that Treehouse of Horror Simpsons episode where Lisa grows a little civilization in a tub?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay, so that's a riff on The Microcosmic God, which is a Theodore Sturgeon story. And I'm betting whoever wrote this story had read The Microcosmic God earlier in that year, because it does deal with like a microscopic civilization that this one scientist has access to. I thought that was like really, that rhymes a little too much. Now, the thing is, The Microcosmic God is a really cool story that's very thoughtful, which this one is not all that thoughtful. But it did strike me as just like, nah, I don't know. Scientists, you know, find some way. Well, it wasn't even sure. In The Microcosmic God, it was like this, just to do it real quick.
He just grows
it's a guy who is a genius for adapting and perfecting other people's inventions, but he doesn't really have the knack for innovation himself. But he has kind of run through whatever anyone else has come up with. And he's frustrated by the lack of scientific progress. So what he does is he creates a microscopic civilization which has a life cycle hundreds of times faster than human beings, so that they can keep advancing technology super fast so that he can then take it and perfect it and get rich off patents.
That's awesome.
That's genius.
It's a cool story. It's a lot of fun.
I feel like the whole microcosmic thing, if that was the genesis of it all, that story has really... It has gone far.
Well, that's true. Yeah, I mean, We have a tentpole blockbuster movie about it right now.
Ant-Man,
Quantumania.
Wait, that's I thought it was just about a poorly CGI'd MODOK, like, kind of hanging out.
It's about the only thing I've seen is one scene that someone has clipped of the poorly CGI'd MODOK talking to some little girl about how the little girl is like, quit being a dick. And he's like, I have been a dick. I don't want to be a dick anymore. And this is like actual dialogue from the fucking movie.
But also, I mean, he's a mechanized organism designed only for killing. He has to be a dick. That's like.
No, that's his purpose.
It's in his
name. You know, it's a Frankenstein story. You know,
he's designed only for killing, Dan.
Designed only for.
Yeah.
Well, look, Lord God designed me to honor and glory him, and I'm not doing that. So.
There may be more about Ant-Man in our cautions section.
Oh, cool.
There's still time to save you, Dan.
I actually saw it.
You fucking idiot.
Oh, marvelous.
Anyways, yeah. I guess you want to, I mean, this is kind of being high points. I don't know what the fuck this was, but you guys want to go into actual low points?
We can hit some low points, sure.
Which is just, mine is just, this drifts along with the logic of a dream. Nothing in it really connects. It's sort of three different stories mishmashed together. And that makes it charming and also stops it from being boring, but also means that it's just like terrible in terms of like if you got this in a creative writing course, you would have to give the kid like at most a C- and say like, hey, let's revise this and make it something.
See me after class. Yeah. The writing was not good. I've done enough of these things by now that I'm forgiving of the radio format. I know that you're going to have to write things differently because you're having to paint a picture for the audience that's listening. But listening to one of the scientist characters describe the little crystal igloo that is the guy's way into the Moonbeam Kingdom and being like, ah, yes, it's about 10 inches high and 8 inches wide. It's like no one would ever say that. I'm sorry. Not even in the most contrived radio drama version of reality.
Look, he's growing. He's on the table now.
There was actually one part where they did this really well, where when he is initially shrinking, the like serum or whatever makes him go temporarily blind. So he has to have them describe stuff to him, but then they don't do that at any other point. And also about halfway through, he comments that he's got a sight back, but they keep narrating anyways.
Which is just like, why did you say that? Yeah, no, classic. I got another low point.
Hit me.
There is a woman character, the sister, who's like, I guess the main antagonist of this. And he's not even in it. It doesn't have any lines. Yeah. They gave like a million lines to the two doctors who just sit around and be like, oh, well done, old chap. Oh, yes.
That's astonishing.
Incredible. It's like, we could have gotten like a little bit from the sister if she's going to play such an important role.
I mean, I think that she's literally only mentioned in one sentence.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. It's like insane because it's just like, I had you stick around here because my sister's a little crazy. And he's and it's like, wait, what? Where is this coming from? And he's like, I'm going to a competency hearing right now. So be sure to come and tell them that I'm not crazy.
That this all really happened. About? Yeah.
I mean, like, they could have just had a couple of lines, like, while he's shrunken with the sister and the two guys, where, like, it's like, oh, okay, clearly the sister's like going for some land or whatever, and she's going to like springboard this on him when he gets back. That would at least connect a little bit. I don't know.
Yeah, I thought the sister was going to try to sabotage him while he was in the Moonbeam, because they said like, oh, she came in and she had a weird expression on her face or something stupid, and that was it.
that's the only thing that's ever said about her.
I was trying to make her like a somehow more threatening, but it never happened.
I mean, one thing that was, one thing that I think kind of sums up a lot of this for me was that, so there's the touch that, you know, he's at his competency hearing with the psych, you know, the board of psychiatrists, and he has a couple of witnesses coming in to testify for him, and they died in a car crash. And like, I kept expecting for it to like at some point be revealed that his sister had like engineered the car crash or like sabotaged their brakes or something, but it never comes up at all. It's just purely coincidental.
Yep. I mean, sorry, you're clearly insane now. So
in the 40s, people died of car crashes like literally all the time.
Now that is true.
The cars back then, not the best.
I literally don't think any of some shit.
I mean, you could have had like literally the same effect from them just like being late.
But yeah,
no, we both died in a car crash.
Yeah, because it seems like if the judge got a call in the middle of the trial waiting for two witnesses and it's like, oh, they died on the way here, be like, okay, we need to like figure this out before we make a sentence.
Fair. That's fair to postpone it by a day.
It seems pretty critical. I mean,
now, here's my counterpoint. What's postponing it going to do? People famously stay dead forever.
He could get somebody else, maybe.
Someone else who's going to back up his insane moonbeam story?
Considering his two collaborators, after presumably working with him and befriending him for years, didn't know about his sister, I guess not.
But I mean, like, okay, then bring the pills that you made that allow you to shrink down to nothing into the court and show the judge. I don't know. This just seems like there's other ways of proving this.
You know, we haven't considered the fact that maybe the moonbeam civilization was behind the car crash.
I honestly thought that this was going to take a serious turn at the end because he got a call and he's like, "I've got terrible news." And I thought he was going to say the two doctors that you were saying no don't exist. They only exist in your head or something. And like this was going to be like some big fantasy, which would make sense why it seemed like a fantasy. And I would have been like, "Okay, this is kind of a bullshit ending, but like whatever. I guess I kind of understand what's going on here." But then I guess they just died in a car crash and the whole moonbeam stuff is all real. So.
And apparently he's going to go in at the end. Although, I guess the moonbeam people already knew about like other worlds and were like trying to crack how to get it. And maybe now that there's no more plague, they're going to just suck him down and he can chill there forever.
I guess so.
The moonbeam civilization was not aware of other civilizations.
Yeah, they were. Not at all weirded out by him because she's like, we know about other worlds. We can't just figure out how to get into them.
Oh,
yeah, it's so stupid too because she comes up and asks him like, "Oh, what are you doing here?" Blah blah blah. And he's like, "Oh, I've never been here." And she's like, "Oh, you're from another land? Okay." And then it's like, "Where are you from?" And then finally he reveals, "I'm from another world." She's like, "I figured that's why I was asking if you were a stranger."
Yeah, and love her chain of reasoning for that is because like, well, our king is king of our entire world. So if you're a foreigner, you would have had to come from somewhere that's not the world.
Yeah, and it's like, why did you ask all those other questions then?
Also, I mean, this is probably me just like projecting my fantasy ideas onto the fantasy world, but it is pretty weird that they've got like apparently a world ruled entirely by one monarch with like people riding horses and castles and shit, but then they also have like scientists who have somehow cracked like string theory or whatever the fuck.
Yeah, you know, it's like it's She-Ra times, you know,
or it's
except
like
without them knowing like how to cure typhoid.
Everyone there are cowboys. Like they have advanced technology, but they choose to use horses because it's more the Montana way.
That's a good point. Yeah,
they're helping themselves get back. Like actually, the week before he went in there, they were all like everyone in the palace was being super arrogant, but then they decided that they needed to go back home and get in touch with their country roots, and that's why they're all riding horses now.
Listen to some George Strait.
Maybe fall in love with a hunky guy who teaches them to love Christmas.
It was just Easter, so it's straw hat season, baby.
Yeah. I don't know. Does anyone really... What else is there to say about this? It's really fucking stupid and bizarre.
The ending oh, right. Sucked. It's yeah. like... It just sort of ends. And I'm
what
like,
else is there to say, though?
I was waiting for a sex scene, Ronald, if you want me to.
The bull was waiting for him to fuck the moonbeam.
The moonbeam or the princess? Or
the same thing, right?
Like, would he stay big? Or...
Yeah, he'll be big.
All right.
He's just sort of tentatively prodding his erection into the moonbeam, being like... Princess, are you there?
Yeah, and the guard walks by and he's like, "Yep, that checks out for what I know about this guy."
Yeah,
I understand why he's locked up.
The guards are like gossiping and be like, "Stay away from that guy in cell 11C. He's a moon fucker." for some reason, Reinfeld is in the cell next to him. Not, it's not part of the joke. I just like the idea of them hanging out.
I don't know. I feel like the ending would have been better if, like, he'd made it back to the Moon Meme civilization. And this is legitimately what I thought was going to happen with him going back, was that time had progressed by, like, 50,000 years, and it was like a dystopian something, and he was just imprisoned there, or something terrible had happened to it.
It would have been a much more interesting idea.
Instead, yeah. It was just like, I'm in a cell, and wait a minute, I hear her voice in the moonbeam in the end.
Yeah.
But like, okay, if it had done that, then it would have been like, oh, there's actually an interesting seed of an idea here, and it wasn't just a random daydream.
And we can't have that. It's like the producer comes back and is like, no, this is too interesting. Yeah. We gotta cut it.
You know what, guys? I'm gonna disagree with you. I think that there were plenty of interesting ideas in this episode. The problem was that they didn't know how to do anything with them.
Yeah, they were not developed at all. And just really just like, and really having like literally the only thing about your amazing microscopic moonbeam world is that the colors are different.
And that at one point he rides an animal that is not described, but is not a horse.
I'm not gonna lie. Okay. I disagree. I don't think there were interesting ideas here. I think that there was one interesting idea that was stolen, which is the microverse thing, and everything else was not interesting.
Folks, you heard it here first. Ronald thinks that going into a civilization inside of a moonbeam is boring.
Oh,
I didn't say it was boring. I said it was stolen.
Well, the moonbeam's new.
Okay, the moonbeam is new. They did a slight twist.
They made it much more confusing and stupid, which in some ways is very interesting.
And it also is like very, very much the story of the entire episode here. Like, there's some ideas that they stole from other things, but made them dumber.
Yeah.
He should have gone back, and then like. He goes back and the world is this dystopian hellscape, and he's like wandering through like destroyed cities and stuff. And then he makes it to like this huge building in this foreign country, and sitting inside of it is this dude with sunglasses, and he's the last guy in the world.
And then that dude with sunglasses starts just acting out the "I wear my sunglasses at night" music video. Why not? Sure.
I would have been okay with it.
Like, I like that music video and indeed love that song. It might suck. I don't know, but I like it.
I don't know. I've never listened to it, but.
You've never listened to it? Yes, you have. I used to play it for you in my car all the time.
I'm talking about you.
I made goddamn sure you heard that song.
Yeah.
No way have you not heard it.
This is a true Lord's fact for the listeners. Throughout like all of 11th grade, I just wore sunglasses continuously for no fucking reason, including while I was driving at night.
That's phenomenal. So
and then
Go ahead, Lawrence.
I would stop at stoplights and I would roll down the windows and be blasting that song. And then I would try to catch people's eyes and gesture my sunglasses so that they could see that I was wearing my sunglasses.
They couldn't actually see your eyes because you were wearing sunglasses at night.
That's the point of sunglasses.
So they were just looking at you, but you were making eye contact with them, but it wasn't vice versa.
But I was trying to get them to acknowledge that I was wearing my sunglasses at night while listening to "I Wear My Sunglasses at Night." And I was also an enormously unsafe driver to be around because I was wearing sunglasses at night. Anyways, Dan.
You kind of need them now, honestly, with some of those headlights. It's ridiculous.
I'm telling you, those LED headlights. No, I was just, I think it's very funny that because around the same time in my life, I too had a stupid affectation where I had this idea where I would keep all of the change from every transaction I had in my pocket and just like keep. And keep transferring it to my new pants and just do that for weeks. Wow. And so I
started like, this giant pocket full of change.
Yeah, so I had this giant like, pocket of change, my left pocket swinging like a fucking flail head because it was full of metal. And it went on for long enough and it seemed, and I have no idea where I got the idea to do it. I don't know why I did it. I just thought it was very funny. And I eventually had one of the most.
You were right about that.
It is so good.
One of the it's I like, had one of the most
it must have been such an inconvenience for me.
It really sucked going to the bathroom and having to like try to do my belt back with all that shit.
Just this also may everywhere. Have
yeah, getting pennies everywhere. And this was I had one of the most vivid dreams of my entire life during this phase because I had a dream that I was in some kind of big box store like Sam's or Costco, and I was trying to buy a single box of chocolatey chip Teddy Grahams. And I was fishing around in my giant, like the you know, the cashier woman was like impatient with me. He's like, you still owe me 25 cents or 50 cents, you know? And so I'm digging around in my giant pocket of change, trying to find the right coin to pay for this, to pay for these Teddy Grahams. And meanwhile, a younger version of me is standing behind me in line, calling me fuckface, telling me to hurry up. And, that's the most vivid dream I've ever had in my life, and it was during my pocket change phase.
Wow. Is that what prompted you to stop doing the pocket change thing? You just because you got like an oracular vision sort of telling you to stop?
I think maybe it was just completely like I must have run out of cash.
You just like used it all.
And it was just like, well, I guess that's the end of that. Okay.
Now, are we sure? I'm going to put this to the group. Are we sure Dan has actually stopped with that phase?
I mean, we would hear the jiggling on the microphone had he not, I feel. And also, at this point in his life, if he'd kept doing it, he would...
It's like a fucking barrel.
It's like he'd essentially, you know those like ball and chains they put on prisoners? It's like that, yes. But with chains.
It would be like that. And quite a metaphor for the United States Mint's insistence on keeping minting the penny. Huh?
Yeah.
There's a real ball and chain. Anyway.
Anyways, you guys want to play a game?
Yeah.
Yeah, let's do it.
Okay, so I should have prepared this better. I should have actually prepared a game before I said, would you like to play a game?
We can go back to an old one that you and I did one time.
What are you thinking? Anything.
Universe fight.
Oh yeah, let's try it.
Okay. So the game is simple. I'm gonna roll a die, you're gonna get two universes, and then two iconic characters from those universes, and then you're gonna decide who wins in a fight between the two of them. Okay. Right.
Yeah. I'll go first to give everyone else kind of a feel, I guess.
Okay. Okay, I'm rolling a D 15.
It is so cool that you can just invent dice that never exist anymore.
Again, physically, like, there's not a platonic solid that can do this for you.
Yeah. Anyways, hit me, right?
Okay. You ready for this?
Yeah.
You may have... I don't remember which ones we did last time, so... Okay, you've got the Nintendo universe with Mario versus the Terminator universe with and T-800 as the iconic character.
Okay, now what this comes down to ultimately, and we did a similar version of this last time, but it comes down to whether or not Mario has his possession cap. Because if he has, if he has his possession cap and he can get that of the Terminator, as we've shown, for some reason the T-800 in Terminator can just kill anything else in the Terminator universe through the sort of power of being, you know, Arnold Schwarzenegger, right? And the only thing
and we know from T3 that he can be possessed.
Yeah. And the only thing that can stop him is, of course, Michael Biehn. And but since they're it's a universe fight, presumably Michael Biehn's on his side, so the Terminator is just unkillable. But if he doesn't have the possessing cap, then I think that the Terminators are going to romp pretty hard. Samus and Star Fox might give him a little bit of trouble, but ultimately, you know, the Nintendo characters exist in a world where death isn't real, and the Terminators are death sort of made into robots. So I'm going to say with the cap, Mario can just kind of squeak it out by being clever. Without the cap, it's just going to be a bloodbath and not even a particularly like long one. The Terminators are just going to wipe everyone out.
Okay. Huh. Dan, what do you think? You want to go next?
Yeah, I like this. Let's have it.
All right. All right. You got the Doom universe with Doom Guy.
Hell yeah. Okay.
Versus the Greek gods and the iconic character is Hercules.
Oh shit! Okay,
this is actually an interesting matchup.
Yeah,
because the Doom guy is really good at killing supernatural entities, and I think in later expansions he does.
That's
kill
exactly
God.
Where I was going with that. It's at first thought you might think, well, you know, the legendary embodiment of physical strength is certainly going to have the upper hand. But Doom Guy is, of course, very, like Lawrence said, he's very skilled in dispatching the mythological and the supernatural. I do think ultimately I'm gonna have to hand it to my man Herc, because as far as we know, Doomguy, as you know, as accomplished as he is a mere mortal, whereas Hercules is a demigod who later ascends to full divinity. And I really think, you know, if you have the ichor of the gods flowing through your veins, that's going to be pretty difficult to knock you down. So I'm going to have to go with Hercules on this, specifically the Hercules in those cheesy Italian movies. I think you can pull it off.
Yeah, I like that. How about the universe versus each other, though? So you got the iconic character part.
But you also have of hell, you know.
Yeah. So right, all of hell, versus the Olympian gods.
But with this version of hell has guns, but also is pretty vulnerable to guns.
I see. Okay. See, that's a little dicier. I mean, we are running into the same thing of like mortality versus immortality, but they are all supernatural and demonic. And really, I'd love to see the Olympian gods get taken down a peg. I'm going to say all the caco demons take them out.
I like that. All right.
Hell yeah. Zeus is going to be felled by the spider mastermind.
Yeah. All right. You ready, Rahul, for yours?
Yeah.
All right. You got the StarCraft universe with Kerrigan. Versus the Universal Monster universe, the iconic character there being Dracula. Like the Mummy, and the Wolf Dracula, Man, and Frankenstein, Wolfman. Yeah.
Laurel and Hardy, Abbott and Costello as well. They're in there.
Yeah, I'm not too familiar.
Abbott and Costello count as the monsters?
They met Dracula, they met the Invisible Man and Frankenstein.
I guess that includes Scooby-Doo then, too. If you think about it.
Oh, wow. Well, that changes the
time. And if you're including Scooby-Doo, I think that brings in Batman.
What?
And the Harlem Globetrotters.
You know, Harlem Globetrotters, yeah.
And you know what else? If you count the new Scooby-Doo and Guess Who, I think it also includes Christian Slater for some reason.
If you include that one Scooby-Doo from the 90s, like real zombies, I think, are in it.
Yeah, so. And wow. If you
what a universe I'd never heard of. So there's a universe that encompasses fucking Frankenstein all the way to Scooby Doo.
I mean,
and the Three Stooges and Batman.
Yeah, the Three Stooges met Batman or Scooby Doo, man. But it's not the good Three Stooges. They'd long died, so it's some like guys who did Three Stooges voices.
It's like whoever held like I guess you know like Mo Howard's niece or whoever held the licensing rights to their likenesses.
Yeah, she's like
just
sure
throwing it at Hanna Barbera for a chicken sandwich.
See, here's the thing, Rahul. I'm pretty sure Scooby Doo has canonically met Frankenstein in the cartoons. So if that's canon. And that means that the Universal Monster universe includes Scooby-Doo. And if it includes Scooby-Doo, it includes all the stuff that's guest starred on Scooby-Doo.
Universal
right. Monster. Right. And it also includes the...
okay.
It would also include the Dark Universe continuity of films.
Yeah.
Oh, so I, Frankenstein.
No. Here's the weird thing. You think I, Frankenstein is in those because it would make more sense. No, I, Frankenstein is actually in the Underworld continuity.
It is?
Yes. They were going to have a stinger scene where he met Kate Beckinsale and then do a tie-up. But then I, Frankenstein made no money because it was stupid and insane. And
that's so good.
Do you guys, Dan, do you know the premise of I, Frankenstein?
I remember I used to listen to the bad movie podcast, The Flop House, religiously. And I know they covered that movie on their show, but I don't remember many details other than one of the hosts, Stuart Wellington, kept calling it I'm Frankenstein, which I thought was a really funny joke.
That is a great joke. But no, the plot of I, Frankenstein is that Frankenstein gets involved in a war between demons and gargoyles who are actually angels for the fate of mankind.
Come on. The whole point of Frankenstein is that he's a monster of science.
No, but that's what makes him so special, because he doesn't have a soul. The angels and demons can't figure out what to do with him, and the demons want to use him to like bring a bunch of demons to Earth, because the fact that he has no soul but has electricity powers is very helpful. And the other problem, of course, is that I, Frankenstein is very hot, and the whole point of Frankenstein is that he is ugly.
Yes.
So anyways,
sounds terrific.
Yeah, who's going to win in this fucking game?
All right. So the epic battle between these two universes is actually...
So do Kerrigan versus Dracula first.
Yeah.
Kerrigan versus Dracula.
Yeah.
All right.
That's a pretty good matchup, actually.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it is.
I feel like they're just going to fuck, though.
They're both, like, very sexually charged.
Yeah, you know, they're fighting, and Dracula's about to land. The killings suck, I guess. But then it turns out he's like, oh, you taste terrible, but you also taste great. And, you know, they start banging. So that's the tie-up
between them. It's a win-win scenario.
So it
but then it turns out that the blood that Dracula sucked out of Kerrigan actually evolved him into a Zergacula. And then, you know, it just goes into the next sequel.
So I just want to point out that apparently Rahul's seduction technique involves telling the woman that she tastes terrible.
But also good.
But also good.
It's called negging, Lawrence.
It's like you're wooing a woman by saying like, hey baby, you ever heard of durian fruit? You're like,
I got a Tupperware in my car.
Hey baby, you like things that smell bad? I got some fruit and something else.
Yeah.
And some rotting flesh.
You heard of this special pitcher plant?
You ever hear of a century plant?
You remind me just of that, babe.
I think that every race in StarCraft, they're just going to keep fighting each other, and then the StarCraft universe isn't coherent enough in terms of purpose to actually beat Scooby-Doo and the gang. Because Scooby-Doo and the gang, they're single-minded. They're tenacious. They'll never stop.
They also have, like, teleportation powers where they can, like, run in one door.
They have a number of ill-defined powers. StarCraft is bound by the laws of physics. I'm sorry. You know?
I have thought of another game that I would like to play very briefly.
All right, let's do it.
Is it called Spin the Bottle?
No.
Sorry. I ruined it.
Okay, so there was a series called Scooby-Doo Mystery Incorporated. It ran in like the mid-2005s, I think. And the weird thing about it is that it is essentially someone trying to do like Deep Space Nine, but for Scooby-Doo, you know, where like a sort of, it maintains this, like the spirit of the original, but it's like trying to make it deeper and more serious and stuff.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm. So I'm gonna just name someone, and I want you to tell me if they were ever did a voice on Scooby-Doo Mystery Incorporated.
I love this.
Yeah.
Okay.
So first of all,
are we doing like the first person to say something or what?
Yeah, just the first person to buzz in, and I don't know. It's not like we're keeping secret.
It's not a trivia round. It's just, let's just see what happens.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. So first off, Lewis Black.
Yes.
Yep. You're correct. Next up, Udo. Next up,
Udo
Kier. The kid's favorite.
Oh yeah, he's definitely.
Yes.
Yeah, he voices an evil parrot named Professor Pericles. Okay, let me see. It's not showing me by episode. Harlan Ellison.
Who is it?
I'm gonna say no.
You're wrong.
No.
The kid's
Harlan Ellison.
He's an incredible science fiction and horror author who wrote "I Have No Mouth and I Must Scream."
Yes. Also, A Boy and His Dog, another of his most famous ones. A famously irascible jerk.
Yeah, he appears to be an asshole, but he writes like really well, and he's got an amusing
voice.
Right.
I guess maybe he owed like a grandkid a favor or something.
Okay. Next up, Beverly D'Angelo.
I don't know who that is, but I'm gonna say yes.
She's an actress. She was in like Christmas Vacation. But yeah, you're right.
Yeah, okay, she was in like mid-2000s stuff, I bet.
Okay. Powers Booth.
I'm starting to see a theme here.
Given how everything has gone, I'm going to say yes.
Yes. Oh, God damn it. Who's the guy who's Reanimator? Jeffrey Combs. Was Jeffrey Combs on Scooby-Doo Mystery Incorporated?
No.
Yes, he was.
Ah, damn it, you got me.
Okay.
You were due.
One more.
I know it was due, man.
Taylor Lautner. Was Taylor Lautner ever on Scooby-Doo Mystery
Incorporated? No, because he wasn't born yet.
He's on the newer Scooby-Doo.
Okay, I can't speak to that. Now, he is not on it. However, they actually have a character named Baylor Hautner, who dates Daphne for a while also dressing up as a giant baby and destroying the town.
But it's not played by him?
No, I guess he didn't have a good enough sense of humor about himself. Oh, and finally, Linda Cardellini.
Yes.
Yeah, but she doesn't voice Velma. She played
Velma. It's like a fun little Easter egg, though, for real Scooby heads.
No, they gave her a full-on character arc. She's in multiple episodes.
Oh, wow.
And then Patrick Warburton and Gary Cole. What do you guys think?
Cool.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, those guys are in everything. Show.
Yeah.
Is it
good?
It's better than it should be. It's also insane, though, as you could kind of tell.
The Dilbert show?
It's better put together than that, because there aren't entire episodes where I'm just sort of like, I don't understand like what you were trying to do here at all.
Yeah.
So I guess what we're really coming away with is that they really already did a Velma, didn't they?
It is a significantly better. Also, I don't know. They gave Fred autism, which is interesting. Like no one
interesting
says
choice.
No one says he's got autism, but he does.
That's
like
kind
he's
of
just
a long character.
Oh, right.
He's just
he can still be hot.
Yeah, but he's utterly.
That's true.
There are multiple scenes where like Velma is essentially Daphne is essentially trying to get him to sleep with her. Like they can't say it because it's a kid show, but you know that's what's going on. But he's like, no, I just want to go read more about traps.
That is pretty great. I had there was a. My wife was friends with a fella who was a lot like that in college. Like he was you know on the spectrum, like a really sweet guy and you know really and good looking, completely oblivious to the way that girls would always just throw themselves at him. Like he was like all about like palling around and having a good time, just never picked up on it. I mean, God bless sweet Eric. He was so cool.
That's the way to be, man. Maintain your energy. Maintain your essence.
That's right.
There you go.
Yeah. Anyways, let's go to recommendations and cautions now that I've done grilling you guys about a mid-2000s. Actually, no, I take it back. It aired in the 2010s, but still.
Oh.
Okay, so that really was Taylor Lautner not being a good sport.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. I feel like that's too early for Taylor Lautner.
You know, I kind of want to do one next where I just, like, rattle off things that, like, did this happen in Scooby-Doo? For instance, in Scooby-Doo, does it turn out that Fred was abducted by a child and raised by someone who is not his father? Yes, that is the thing.
It's too specific to not be at this point.
It does turn out to do that, yes.
Yeah. Anyways, okay, so recommendations and cautions. Dan, you want to hit me?
Yeah, sure. I got a little recommendation for y'all. So something that if you spend any amount of time around me in real life, you'll eventually get to know that I am a big paleontology enthusiast.
Oh, yeah.
I am really, really fascinated with the history of life on Earth, the science of piecing together what we can know about it, the science of piecing together what we can't know about it. Yeah, I just think it's a really, you know, it's a fascinating realm of human inquiry and just a really cool body of knowledge that we have developed. But my particular interest lies in what have been known historically as the, quote, mammal-like reptiles, end quote. And these are the animals that eventually, of course, as the name kind of implies, these are the group of animals that mammals like you and me eventually arose from. But their origins go back to the kind of split between, you know, once you had amphibians, and then you eventually had the first what were called amniotes, that is the first animals that were able to lay eggs outside of the water. So you're not like a frog with, you know, tadpoles, but you can lay eggs outside of the water. The family tree splits all the way back there about 300 million years ago. And on one side, you have the mammal line, the synapsids. On the other side, you have the reptile and bird line, the sauropsids. It also has your dinosaurs, your lizards, your birds, all that stuff over there. So for a good long while, 50, 60 million years, it was animals on the mammal line that were the dominant land animals before there was any such thing as a dinosaur. And it's a fascinating story. It's really the first go that the Earth had at large-bodied terrestrial ecosystems, right? These were the first animals. These were mammal cousins. They're not mammals, and they look really weird. But these were the first animals that developed kind of what we might call the cow lifestyle of being a big-bodied herbivore. These were the first animals that developed a predator lifestyle, eating the other big meaty animals. Like, this was kind of the first pass at it all. And it's very fascinating to me. It's also, as you might guess from my little intro there, this is pretty esoteric stuff. It's a lot of the material on it for the popular press is just next to non-existent. The best you can hope for is if you have a kid's book about dinosaurs, is that they'll have a Dimetrodon in it. And you guys have seen this. It looks like a big Komodo dragon with a sail on its back.
Mm-hmm. That thing rules, man.
Dimetrodon.
Yeah. It's one of the coolest animals ever. Listen, and it's closer to us than it is to dinosaurs.
That's
one of
crazy.
Us.
I didn't know that.
Isn't that rad? It's so cool. So this is all to say, I recommend a recent popular press book called Beasts Before Us, The Untold Story of Mammal Origins and Evolution by the paleontologist Elsa Panciaroli. It's a really cool, very accessible, breezily written, basically it's a book for kind of the educated layman about these animals and the science around discovering what we can know about them. And kind of the story of how they were the dominant life forms on the planet. And then the Great Permian extinction happens, almost completely wipes out terrestrial life, except for a handful of animals, which would later become the tiny scurrying proto-mammals that we evolved from. And eventually the great, of course, titanic dinosaurs that would dominate Earth for 150 million years while we were kind of scurrying between their feet, waiting for our time to, get it all back. But it's a really great book, Beasts Before Us. It's a really cool intro to this really overlooked, in my estimation, criminally overlooked aspect of the history of life on Earth. It can be a little bit, it's one of those where like the author's heart is in the right place, but it comes across as a little preachy and ham-handed when she brings up things like the kind of the history of colonialism when it comes to how these remains are discovered and analyzed and kind of the impacts of things like misogyny on the field and stuff like that. I feel like they could have been worked in a little more gracefully than Miss Panciaroli does it, but at the end of the day, it's really cool that someone set out to write a book that I could just like tell people like, hey, you can listen to me go on about this, or you can read this really cool book and you'll have like a way in on this kind of esoteric but really, really neat topic.
Dan,
so, yeah, Beasts Before Us.
I just want to put my marker down that there are very few books that I would rather like read than listening to you talk.
Aww, thank you, Lawrence. I do appreciate that.
So, but Dan's going to go all to Lawrence's those... and read the book to him, or what's
when's Dan's book coming out?
Man, I don't even talk about that. I can't. I have thoughts, but I will not. No, we won't do that. But thank you, Lawrence. I would think for everyone else who wrongheadedly would rather read a book, this is a good book to read.
Or just doesn't have access to Dan, I guess.
Yeah, I'm going to start reading this tonight. It sounds very...
Yeah, I literally just bought it.
Sounds awesome.
So that woman who wrote it owes you money now.
Yeah, that's how it works.
Put food on her table.
Y'all, I'm just happy to spread the word, and when y'all read about Gorgonopsians, you're gonna love it.
I have a question that may or may not be covered in this book, but since you're here, how did those monstrous herbivorous dinosaurs ever eat enough for their humongous size?
Rahul, that is such a phenomenal question, and the answer is. I'm not entirely sure, but it's something that I think about all the fucking time.
Like a whole tree?
There are a couple of angles to have on this. And one is that their bodies were so huge, and that means there's a lot of gut space, right? So that means stuff can sit in there for a long time.
Oh, so they're kind of
and
hollow.
Break down. So they're able to
like
the
a
ideas that
on legs.
Exactly. So the idea is that they could take in a lot of what we would think of as low nutrition value plant material, like stems and just kind of scrape. They would literally like their teeth were designed. A lot of these the sauropods, their teeth were designed to basically like. They would deep throat a branch and close their mouth around it and then just pull back and strip all the leaves and twigs.
Oh,
off of it.
Nice.
Like that's how their teeth were designed to work. And so the idea is that you would be able to get enough energy out of that if it was just able to sit in your gut and ferment for long enough. The other thing is that like there, it may be that plant life was more productive. That there were basically like there was just more stuff and more energy stored in the stuff growing out of the earth because it was a warmer time in earth history, right? So that it was a little more conducive. Yeah, you had more oxygen in the atmosphere. You had more, there may have been a way like basically like there was just more stuff to eat. And so you could get really, really big. But there's a, if your public library subscribes to the Hoopla ebook service, in their collection, they have the terrific put out by the Indiana University University Press called Life of the Past series. And there's a book there that was written by a team of German paleontologists who had like basically had a little conference to get together and like, look, we got to work on the actual physiology of sauropods because what the hell's going on there? And so it's a whole book with various chapters about all these questions, like what kind of like, and one of my favorite ones was like their blood pressure. What kind of blood pressure would it
take? How could they reach their head, right?
Like, yeah. And like some of the estimations, it was basically like if you're like an Allosaurus chasing after like a sauropod and you managed to get like luckily like nick an artery in its neck, it would basically like spray like a fire hose because their blood pressure had to be so fucking high. And that may or may not be the case. Like it might be that they had some special tissues to like it's kind of secondary hearts kind of help stuff move around. You know, we don't
like
really know.
Giraffes exactly, have like a special setup, right? Just to
kind of works to kind of help blood move along. But that's a great question, one that I don't know the answer to, but a lot of people think a lot about it, and so there's a lot of cool material about it.
Cool.
I'm gonna go next. Wait, Dan, do you have a caution?
No, I'm feeling positive tonight.
Yeah, because you got to talk about your beloved things that aren't quite dinosaurs.
I got that, and I'm just like I'm riding the high. I'm just all love right now. I can't be a hater.
Yeah. Okay, so I'm going to recommend something, which is that I finally like bit the bullet and read the first Caiaphas Cain novel. This is For the Emperor by Sandy Mitchell. And you know what? This beloved book that like basically every Warhammer fan likes, pretty good.
Oh, sweet.
It's about...
That's one I haven't read those either. I'll have to check it out.
Yeah, it's about Caiaphas Cain, who he claims to be like a selfish coward, but his real deal appears to be that he's like the only like normal, like reasonable man in the entire Imperium. And he's a commissar whose main like thing is just he wants everyone to be chill and leave him alone so that he can get drunk and maybe whore. But he keeps like people keep like setting his regiment into combat. So he has to make his regiment super good at combat because if they're good at combat, he has a better chance of staying alive. And he gets dispatched to a planet dealing with Tau influence. And I thought it was weird that they're going with a kind of deep cut race like the Tau in the first book. But so he has to like help his like try to resolve the diplomatic situation, and he gets involved in the Inquisition. And it turns out there's a larger, deep conspiracy to try to make a war happen with the Tau. It's not perfect. And in particular, the action scenes are not very good because they're like they tend to end very abruptly after like a few lines. Which action is hard to write. I don't blame the guy too much for being like, fuck it. You know, you shoot him with a melta and they die. We're done. But yeah, but it's pretty delightful to see this guy just walking around Warhammer being reasonable and saying like, no, we shouldn't summarily execute these guys because we might need them later. And also it would be bad for morale. Yeah. And then my other like recommendation is that I watched Accident Man, which is a 2018 movie starring the man, the myth, the legend, Scott Adkins. And he also co-wrote it. The writing isn't actually very good. He was trying to like, I think, do Tarantino dialogue, but Scott Adkins is many things, but he's not Quentin Tarantino level of writing. His Quentin Tarantino is more just, he's like the Quentin Tarantino of like really elaborate action sequences, but the action scenes here are incredible. There's this long sequence where it's just him and I think Amy Johnston. And yeah, she's like, who's a stunt woman and she's got a sword and he doesn't. And they're like constantly getting into it. Just, and then there's one where it's him and Ross O'Hennessy, who played the Lord of Bones on Game of Thrones. And Ross O'Hennessy is just like cackling like a madman and trying to hit him with an axe. And Scott Adkins has to deal with the fact that the guy has an axe and he doesn't. It's very fun. Just watch it for the action scenes. Maybe fast forward a little bit because they're trying to do some slightly edgy jokes about lesbians that I don't think are coming from a hateful place, but aren't really landing either. But whenever you see two people about to square up and start punching, just, you know, watch that shit and you'll have a fantastic time. Anyways, Ronald, what do you got for us?
Yeah, sure.
If you I actually go watch Ant-Man, I am going to make fun of you. Just
I did, yes.
You fucking idiot.
Yeah. Okay, look, I will defend my actions here. I fucking love going to the movie theater. And there have not been a lot of movies that have been coming out in the past like 6 months. Not a lot of blockbusters. Even ones that I'm not that interested in. I will say I wasn't like super excited to see this movie, but my caution is Ant-Man and the Wasp, Quantumania. It may not be as terrible as you think, depending on what your perspective on this movie is. It wasn't horrible, but the writing was hack. And I don't know. It was fine. I had a good time. Because I went to one of those theaters where you eat dinner and get popcorn. So I had a good time doing that. I would not watch the movie again.
Ronald, someday you're going to find out about these restaurant things and you're going to lose your shit.
They don't have... Okay, the Alamo near my house makes incredible popcorn. If restaurants had this, I don't know how much I would go to the movies. You know, I've tried to reproduce it at home. Trust me, I've tried every oil, Flavacol... I've tried the different seeds, different popping oils, and like flavoring oils. Trust me, I've tried it. I don't know how they do it.
I would trust you with my life. Maybe I should just ask the chef.
I would trust you with my life, but I would not trust you to make popcorn. Apparently,
I can make great popcorn. It's just not the same.
Can you do it without burning it? Can you do it without charring it to a crisp, Ronald?
Ronald, you say you make good popcorn, but can you do it without pooping directly on the popcorn before you hand
you said
it?
You said you wanted good popcorn.
It holds the flavor.
You know, after all the shit I gave you about poop, I'm the one who brought it up.
It's always you, Lawrence. It's always you.
You're always starting it, and then I get the blame.
Yep.
Anyways. Okay, and then recommendation. I don't remember if I recommended this already, but a movie from 2022 called The Menu. Delightful movie. It was really fun. It's not particularly scary, which is kind of how it was billed, I feel like. It was like, it seems like it's kind of like a horror satire, but it's not too horror-y. I mean, even a horror satire wouldn't be scary, but it's not even really going into that. It's more like satirizing like class structure, but it's pretty fun. Anya Taylor-Joy is the main character, and she's kind of trapped at this dinner party with a famous chef who, played by Ralph Fiennes, who kind of goes off the rails and is maybe killing everyone. It's a fun time to see like what the heck's going on, and making fun of like foodie culture, kind of. So yeah, it was a good time. I enjoyed it, and I think it's on HBO Max, so you do not have to go to the movie theaters for that one. That's it for me.
And finally, Rahul, what do you got for us?
I have no recommends, no cautions, because I've done nothing in the intervening time from our last episode, but
you say this somewhat often and it kind of depresses me a little bit. You should be doing more with your life.
He recommends weightlifting.
Yeah. I recommend weightlifting.
You know what? I'm going to go ahead and recommend, like, if you can get Rahul to send you a picture of his like biceps, pretty fucking good.
pretty nice. They're not. Yeah. Sometimes when the light is right though, I'm like, damn.
Oh, baby.
But usually they're pretty underwhelming.
I thought they were strong. I don't know. What do I know?
But I, you know, an interesting video has been making the rounds on social.
Oh, that's Jesus what
I'm going to plug. I'm going to plug this video. I'm going to put it in the Zencast chat. I think it is so funny. Like,
God damn it.
It's just so great.
What the fuck?
What is this?
This Rahul in continuing his streak of absolutely fucking baffling YouTube videos has somehow found a Russian account, of course, that has posted the 1958 NFL championship halftime show.
It's 9 seconds of it.
Which is women in kind of sexy for the 1950s reindeer costumes. Pulling the air,
prancing poorly.
It's so funny how primitive entertainment technology was.
I know, right? I know they had better shows back then.
The thing is, it's like football was low rent at that time.
Oh, really? It wasn't like a huge deal like it is now?
No, it was like, well, I mean, it was still a huge deal. It was becoming big, but it was like looked down upon, frowned upon.
No way.
I don't know how familiar you guys are with the Mystery Science Theater oeuvre of shorts. If you've ever watched many of those. And they're mostly from the Joel era. They kind of go back. But they used to like pad out the show, you know, if it was a particularly like short or crappy movie, they'd have like a short film with it. And so they did a lot of like film strips that would be shown to like high school students kind of stuff. And there was one about like, it was a cautionary tale about two youngsters rushing off to get married when maybe they should listen to mom and dad. But part of the shtick is that they're going to quit college because the boyfriend already has his pro football career lined up, and the parents are shaking their heads at that.
Oh, because that's
like fly by night bullshit. That's carny stuff.
Oh, wow. I mean, this video makes it seem that way. Like,
yeah.
It looks to me like they're at a racetrack.
Yeah, it really was. It was kind of the redheaded stepchild of professional sports for like really up until like the kind of the dawn of the Super Bowl era. And like the 70s and 80s is when it kind of got respectable.
Huh.
Wow.
Well, anyways, Rahul, you continue to just baffle me with how the fuck you find these videos.
There's something wrong with my YouTube account, man. I don't even know.
See, that's how Rahul gets so jacked, is he's scrolling through all these YouTube accounts like looking for cool archival footage.
Okay. I would like to close the show with one thing.
Okay.
Which is Dan, Ronald, and me just go to YouTube and tell me the first video that it is recommended to you.
Okay.
All right,
let's see.
Or actually read the first three if you're on your desktop, because it shows you a bunch.
Alright, you ready?
What are yours first?
C-Bum fails his squat, so he stands up and racks it.
Okay.
Number two is, how do we know that cholesterol causes heart disease? Number three is, the girl that goes out every night.
Okay, is that a song, or what is that?
It's a funny skit video.
Okay.
From the looks of it.
So mine are an animated Cumtown bit called Nick Loses His One Shot at Love. Can any three bosses defeat Melania, which is an Elden Ring video.
Like
which
Melania
is curious.
Trump? Or...
No.
Oh, okay.
Which is curious because I have played Elden Ring for about 3 minutes. And then diving into day 14 of the Waukesha Parade attacker trial.
Oh, no.
God.
All right.
Dan, what are yours?
Mine are pretty embarrassingly on brand. This is... Okay, you'll see what I mean. My first result. Top five prehistoric gliding animals.
Wait, send me that one.
Yeah, I mean, it looks pretty tight. I've actually watched this guy's stuff before. It's really good. I'm going to send that in the chat.
Yeah. All right.
Let's see. Make that go through. There you
what
go, fellas.
Top mean?
I don't know.
I guess we'll see in the video.
he'll explain it to you.
He'll explain it. I'm sorry for
enormous
asking.
Yeah. So the second one is the first modern war, the Boer War, 1899 to 1902. And my third recommendation is Islamic non-dualism, the Sufi poetry of Al-Shushtari.
Jesus Christ, Dan, your YouTube is like you must be real smart to have a YouTube
very
like
educational.
That.
Jesus, man.
And Rahul or Ronald, what were yours?
All right, mine. The first one is Noam Chomsky manufacturing consent.
Oh, classic! Yeah, that's classic. Very good.
I think I've watched that one before.
That's probably a little long to be recommended. That's too long for a modern audience.
It's only a 9-minute video.
So. Oh, weird.
And then the second one is Texas Red Chili Bowl of Red, which is, I think it's a recipe video. Like a
challenge?
Horrifying.
Yeah. You drink a whole bowl of.
Yeah, a bowl of red. I don't know. It doesn't make it sound very appetizing. And then the third one is relaxing Nintendo music video game, mostly Nintendo with night ASMR.
You know, if it had been the ASMR, yeah, that would have been a pretty respectful one. But the fact that YouTube is serving you, you know. I guess Dan's is definitely the least embarrassing. And I think
thank you for saying so, because I was like, fuck. This has got me.
Dan's is the most like impressive. I'm just like, oh fuck, I waste my time on YouTube.
I think mine might be the most embarrassing because we've got a Cumtown bit, a hacked video from a game I do not play, and then the trial of a mass murderer that I for some reason got briefly obsessed with.
Everything involving you, Lawrence, is so embarrassing that it's off the scale. So it's easier just to start without you. You know.
Well, I mean, if it's not me, then you're the most embarrassing one.
Yeah, yours are all like Russian videos about getting ripped or whatever.
How is that embarrassing?
This is a kind of interesting game because I think it's a really good insight into everyone's, like, I don't know, interests, psyche, whatever.
Yeah, but
I don't think anyone is too embarrassed by their own recommendation.
No, I'm not at all.
I really kind of wish I hadn't gotten so into the Daryl Brooks trial. I now regard that as kind of embarrassing.
But honestly, with the YouTube algorithm, you can click on like two videos and it'll start surfacing those. So yeah, it's very reactive.
No, I mean, no, but I did like watch literally like 20 to 30 hours of that trial.
He was trying to gracefully let you
testify. It's like, no, I love this trial.
I mean, I don't love it anymore, but look, once you can disconnect from the fact that, six people died and many people got injured, the fact that this guy tried to use a sovereign citizen defense while, like, defending himself from murder is pretty funny, kind of. Like, he kept trying to call the fucking state of Wisconsin as a witness. What the fuck? And during his closing, like, he started, like, trying to talk the jury into nullifying the laws against murder.
Nice. That makes sense, I guess. Is he just at this point just like, fuck rules?
And no one knows, man.
I can't imagine that most sovereign citizens are like all there.
Stupid. I mean, you can't be like, murderous cool. Like, that doesn't make any sense.
I think at a certain point he's just he's a psychopath with a persecution complex and thought that he was the victim of a conspiracy and would hope the jury would see it that way. And then during the sentencing, he got all his like mother and grandmother and so on to come in and talk about how he needed mental health treatment, which prompted the judge to explain very patiently that she did not have the ability to do that, even if she wanted to. Which again, very funny aside from the whole, he killed six people. It's really, right, kind of got to keep that in your head.
Kind of puts a pall on the whole thing.
Yeah. Anyways, from all of us at Bad Time, we've done it. From all of us at Bad Time Radio, don't worship Satan. It's bad for you.
If you'd like to recommend an episode of Old Time Radio for us to listen to, send us a question for the mailbag or a pedantic correction, you can reach us at radiobadtime@gmail.com. Our theme music is Finger in the Bottle by We Ashore Dedicated off their album No Ski Here Okie Sap. Thanks so much for listening.
What's gonna get?